This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and glad to have you with us. Welcome to hour number two of the show. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about hate crimes in the United States. And our guest for the show is Brian Levin. He is a criminologist and a civil rights attorney. He is associate professor of criminal justice and also director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism that's based at California State University in San Bernardino, where he specializes in analysis of hate crime, terrorism, and legal issues. Previously, he served as associate director for legal affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama. He was also legal director of the Center for the Study of Ethnic and Racial Violence in Newport Beach, California. He's authored a number of books and articles dealing with extremism and hate crime. He has testified before Congress and been advisor to various units of the government, just to name a few, the FBI, the Department of Justice, Treasury, also organizations like the American Bar Association and the National District Attorneys Association and the International Association of Chiefs of Police. That also has been widely interviewed on television and radio, talking about subjects including civil rights, criminal law, and extremism. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and we're pleased that he could give us some of his time. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us. If it would be a long-distance call for you, you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, or even people who might be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, any of all those folks can use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. And just in, let us bring you up to date, because right at the end of the newscast, the word was that there would be a verdict announced in the case of Louis Libby, and there is one here. I want to pass it on to you, that former White House aide Louis Libby has been found guilty in the CIA leak case. That is just off of the Associated Press newswire. That's all the information we have on the story right at the moment, but I am certain that throughout the day in our coverage from National Public Radio, there will be more, and you can certainly expect that there would be extensive coverage as part of All Things Considered. This afternoon begins here on AM 580 at 4 o'clock. Well, with that, we turn to our guest here this morning, and Professor Levin, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, we appreciate it. Let's start with a story that may, in fact, not be a story. And maybe people saw this. We certainly collected some articles that appeared recently. Looking at concerns that there might be a resurgence of activity and perhaps also membership by the Ku Klux Klan. In fact, it seems like as sort of a separate issue, there seems to be concern that groups like this are drawing some strength from the kind of debate that we're having now in this country about immigration, particularly about illegal immigration. But let me save that for a second and just go to the basic question about resurgence of the Klan. Is that in fact happening?
It certainly was happening. From about 2000 to 2001, the Klan really hit the historic lows as far as membership, as far as activity, and they really bounced off those lows. However, a couple of things. First, it is that they bounced off the lows. So, for instance, we're talking about, you know, a group that's somewhere between 5,000 and 7,500 nationwide. And additionally, we haven't seen the kind of Klan criminality that we saw during the 70s, the 80s, and obviously in the 20s and the 50s and 60s. So, yes, there's been a resurgence. Yes, it was dramatic, but it was like a penny stock bouncing off of an all-time low. Hmm. So if it were a stock, I'd say don't buy.
is it the case that there might be, I guess here, let me ask a very general question about the strength of organizations, of groups like that, organized groups who, and I suppose the thing that we think of most are groups that are white supremacist, although that's not all the hate crimes are not white on black or white on Latino. But if you think about sort of those kinds of classic organized, perhaps militant, extreme right-wing groups, is there, you know, have we seen significant increases in the incidence of those kinds of groups, their membership, their activities, any more today or in the last few years than we have seen perhaps within the last decade?
Great question. And let me try and parse it out. There are groups that are part of the legitimate mainstream debate about immigration. There are plenty of people of goodwill who want a more conservative position with regard to immigration who are not bigoted. However, there are others who are. So the issue goes across the spectrum as far as looking at groups. So, for instance, we have groups like the Klan and various neo-Nazi groups that are exploiting this. But we also have groups like, for instance, here in California, a group called Save Our State. And if you look at their website, the kind of imagery and the kind of rhetoric looks very similar to what we saw on the White Aryan Resistance page not that long ago. So that's a group where they say that they're not bigoted, but the neo-Nazis show up at all their rallies, and they're never repudiated by the head of the group. So you have the clear hate groups, you have the ones who are kind of straddling the line, and then you have the more mainstream groups, of which there might very well be people who have infiltrated it, who have more nefarious motives. So that's kind of the three-part show that's going on now.
So it does, though, seem to be the case that that the concerns about immigration, and I would expect that primarily this would be concerns about illegal immigration, and something that is and has been now for a couple of years a subject of national debate, that is an issue that groups like this have grabbed onto. And it is something that they want to talk about, they want to address, and it sounds like that it is something that they can use to recruit or at least to try to find people like-minded individuals.
Oh, absolutely. This issue is different things for different people. Mm-hmm. For legitimate mainstream discourse, it's an area of genuine public debate. People are concerned about resources. People are concerned about border security, a whole variety of issues. However, it's also, if you're a hate monger, a wonderful opportunity to take the fear that exists and the concern that exists and exploit it for its bigotry currency. And that's what's being done. Look, the Klan's never going to get a mainstream person of goodwill to join. But what they will get are people who were considering joining a hate group and just needed to get kicked over the edge into joining one. That being said, again, remember, we're talking about a nation of 300 million people. We're talking about, you know, maybe 7,500. That's on the more liberal side of the numerical estimates. You know, during the 1920s, Klan was 4 to 5 million. You had people who would later become senators and Supreme Court Justice and President Harry Truman, you know, as members of the Klan. So it's a whole different animal now. It's a shell of its former self. I think the thing for those of us who monitor the Ku Klux Klan is that many of us thought, wow, will the group actually survive as a continuing entity? And what had happened is they experienced a significant growth in the years from 01 through about last year. I think you'll see that they kind of peaked out around 2006. Again, their membership has increased, still very small, and also you haven't seen the kind of criminality committed by Klan members that we saw before. So I think sometimes the headline, while accurate, doesn't show the whole picture. One other quick thing. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a nationwide resurgence. You know, I was quoted in an AP story, and quite accurately, by the way. And I went to a meeting here in California. They said, you know, hey, Brian, what are you talking about the Klan? We're not seeing it in California. We're seeing other groups. And that's absolutely right. Here in the West Coast, we haven't seen really a significant resurgence. It was a multi-regional resurgence that hit like the Mid-Atlantic, some of the breadbasket states, the Midwest. But it was not a national resurgence. So, you know, I'd even say the Klan isn't as active now as it was maybe a couple of decades ago.
Well, that let me just ask you one further question, and I have some people here, and I should apologize to them. I don't mean to make them wait forever, but for someone like you, or for the various organizations that are interested in monitoring the activities of these kinds of groups, just indeed keeping an eye on them, what it is they're doing, what it is they're saying, what their membership might be, and so forth. That the you're obviously going to be paying attention to what's going on. Is this something, the fact that we have the continuing presence of these groups, that perhaps at least over a period of years there was a not enormous but, you know, significant growth in membership, is that to what extent is that something to worry about or to be concerned about, or is that more just something that you would say, well, it's something that we ought to be aware of and we ought to be keeping an eye on, but it's not something to lose sleep over?
I don't think it's anything for any of your listeners to lose sleep on. It's something for me maybe to lose a little sleep on. But again, you know, the thing is, what we see with these hate groups on the far right hate side of the fence, I am not talking about conservative people of goodwill. Please don't call. I'm not talking about you.
Yeah.
But I'm talking about the neo-Nazis, the Ku Klux Klan, that kind of thing. What we commonly see is a period of time where a particular genre has a great couple of years. We saw with the National Socialist Movement a couple of years ago, and now they're kind of out of favor. So what I thought was interesting is that, you know, we kind of thought that, you know, maybe the Klan wouldn't be highly operational, and they still managed to grow off those bottoms, those near historic lows. But again, you know, most of it has been like rallies and recruitment. And the other thing, too, that I think is interesting is that one of the reasons why the Klan didn't grow that much here is because there's no pool of potential recruits for them here. It's a little bit more complex, the hate movement on the West Coast. So what we're seeing is the Klan made inroads in places where they had a traditional base, like the South, and also in areas where you had virtually a homogeneous population become a bit more heterogeneous with the increase in immigrants coming in. So I'm not particularly worried about it. I think you're going to see that 06 was where they hit their ceiling. And what I'm more worried about with regard to this kind of stuff are other groups, neo-Nazi groups, or these kind of wolf in sheep's clothing type groups like Save Our State, which don't carry that baggage historically that the Klan has, and people joining up with those kind of groups. That's what I worry about. And again, one other quick thing. And that is, you know, most hate crimes are not committed by hardcore hate mongers or people who are members of organized groups. So I worry more about the Klan influence, and even moreover, I worry about those groups that try and straddle the line, encouraging fellow travelers to go out and commit some vigilante acts, rather than I worry about the Klan. That being said, you know, are there violent people in the Klan? Sure. Have there been historically? Yes. But the one thing that hasn't been taking place has been a resurgence in Klan violence of any great significant degree.
Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, Brian Levin. He is a criminologist and civil rights attorney. He specializes in the analysis of hate crime, terrorism, and legal issues. He is an associate professor of criminal justice and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University in San Bernardino. And he is there. He's speaking with us this morning by telephone. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Kankakee to talk with. Here, bring him into the conversation. This is line 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Your caller has three quick questions, all related. What might it be about the perpetrator of a crime disliking his victim that would aggravate a crime and place it in the new category of hate crime? Two, could not one make a valid argument that were the perpetrator to like the victim? That could be the aggravating factor. And three, for what purpose might there be a need to label certain crimes hate crimes? The conspiratorial nature of some crimes should not confuse us. Thank you.
All right. Well, I think those are good questions, and probably the very first one does indeed go to a question that we should talk about, just in case there's anybody who might be not sure what it is we're talking about, and that is the definition. What qualifies as a hate crime?
Great question. It varies from state to state. In Illinois, you've had a statute called the Ethnic Intimidation Statute. That's your hate crime statute there in Illinois. We have a variety of different types of hate crime statutes on the books, but they're very similar, so if I could talk generically, if you don't mind.
Mm-hmm.
There are two basic kinds functionally. One is an enhancer. What that does is that it enhances the penalty on an underlying offense like a robbery or an assault or a kidnapping, for instance, if in fact there is a biased motive with that underlying offense. So that's one thing. In other words, where you have to charge an underlying offense, and then once there's a guilty finding on that, then there has to be established beyond a reasonable doubt the biased motivation. Secondly, there are laws that are just standalone laws where you don't need an underlying charge put through. You just charge that separately as a civil rights violation. Either way, the concept is similar. What the Supreme Court has established in a case called Wisconsin versus Mitchell back in 1993, is that penalty enhancement laws for hate crimes, when carefully drafted, are constitutional. And I wrote a couple of briefs in that case, and they go to the heart of what those excellent questions were. Let me begin by this. The criminal law consistently takes into account a variety of factors engaging punishment among seemingly similar types of conduct. So, for instance, if you're disorderly on a street corner, you'll be treated differently if you try it on an airplane. If you commit an arson against a barn, that's different from an occupied structure. So what the court looked at was that we gauge punishment for a bunch of reasons. And what are some of the things we gauge punishment on? We look at the offender. Is the offender a recidivist? We look at the victim. Is the victim vulnerable because of age or disability or youth? We also look at the instrumentality of the way attacks take place. If you commit a crime with a gun, you'll be treated differently than if you commit a crime with a knife. We look at the location. If you sell drugs within 1,000 feet of a school. So the notion that a crime is just a crime in modern criminal law isn't really true. So what we did with hate crime, and one of the things that I did in the briefs and have done before and since, is to try and establish whether or not hate crimes are a qualitatively different type of offense which would warrant additional punishment. And I think moral concerns aside, which are very important and can be taken into account, the criminal law looks at the context in which crimes occur, it looks at the motive of the offender, and it looks at the actual patterns that take place in these particular types of crimes. For instance, not every drunk driver gets into an accident, but there's a particular risk and harm to society from not punishing drunk drivers. So what myself and other researchers have established is that hate crimes are actually, leaving aside the issues of morality and discrimination, which are legitimate issues, by the way, but from a criminological standpoint, they are more likely to involve groups of attackers. They're more likely to involve attacks against persons as opposed to property. When there is a physical attack, these attacks are more likely to involve injury and hospitalization. And again, you have groups of attackers oftentimes on lone victims. So if you parsed it out merely to look at the characteristic traits of hate crimes, one of the things that the research has established is that they're a more violent type of offense. The other thing, too, is that offenders oftentimes commit these acts serially, many times against the same victim, and most of the people who do this have diluted motives. They're not hardcore hate mongers. They're people who are protecting turf, or they're people who are doing it for excitement. So the criminal law, by enhancing penalties, can send a message to a would-be offender who has a diluted motive. In other words, he's not committed to it, to say, look, if you do this thing for fun, guess what? There's a heightened penalty here. It's not just boys will be boys. So the notion is that hate crimes are a more severe type of offense just with regard to the criminological standpoints. But additionally, discrimination is something that the government has held is within its authority to punish. So if we could punish someone in the civil realm, like if your radio station refused to hire African Americans, we could certainly punish the radio station for that. Well, we can do the same with regard to offenders. One last quick point. The statute that the Supreme Court looked at concentrated more on the fact that someone intentionally selects a victim rather than the fact that they have hatred. It just so happens many of the people who commit hate crimes have negative, nasty stereotypes to some degree. But the way the statute was written, and I think that's good, is that they didn't concentrate so much on whether it was an idea that we don't like, because that's getting to First Amendment area. It's rather, did an intentional selection of a victim based on their race. An example of that would be, you can't have a law saying it's a crime to hate the president, but you can have a law saying it's a crime to threaten or assault the president. So I apologize for the long-winded explanation, but I tried to hit the questions that were asked by the caller.
Well, yeah, and I think that you did an excellent job. I guess just to sum up, the thing that I that seems important is you're going to understand what is or was not a hate crime. It does have to do with the motivation of the alleged criminal, and that if, for example, we have a case where person A commits assault against person B, that you have to establish the fact that person A selected person B because of some group that person belongs to, that it could race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, religion, some people, because we have seen a disturbing incidence of attacks against people who are homeless, some people who think that should be an acceptable category to make the allegation that this is a hate crime. It's not just that person has been picked randomly. Is there something about that person that figures in the whole thing according to their identification, their group membership, and that's what it is. And I suppose that also that can make it difficult sometimes, because then if you're going to prosecute, if you're going to charge someone that way, you've got to be able to establish, in fact, that there was that motive and that they picked that person for that reason.
Right. And if I could just add a couple of small yet important points.
Yeah.
In many states, they've added language, actual or perceived race, or association with. What the heck does that mean, Professor Levin? Well, I'll tell you. If I attack you because I think you're Jewish, and it turns out you're not, the statute written that way, that says actual or perceived, would still cover that.
Yeah, it doesn't matter that you're not. The fact that it was the intent of the attacker, not that the actual fact of the victim's identity.
Right, and there's also language dealing with association. What does that mean? Well, what if a white supremacist goes after another white person because he's in an interracial relationship? That would be covered by that wording as well. But yes, you're exactly right, and I'd be more than happy to talk about violence against the homeless, because I'm actually part of an effort nationally, and including here in California, to get states to add homelessness either to their hate crime statutes or to their vulnerable victim statutes, which makes it a crime to go after people who are particularly vulnerable. And we've seen double the number of homicides of homeless people than all the other hate homicides combined over a six-year period.
I think that is very interesting. Let me just quickly Reintroduce you for the benefit of people who might have just tuned in. We're talking this morning with Brian Levin. He is a criminologist and a civil rights attorney. He's particularly interested in doing analysis of hate crime, of terrorism, and he has written books and papers and done a lot of talking on this subject. He's often interviewed and quoted in the media. He's a criminologist and civil rights attorney. He is associate professor of criminal justice and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at Cal State University in San Bernardino. He's joining us by telephone here. We're talking about hate crimes and extremism in the United States. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I do think that it is interesting, and again, it helps further to, I think, to illustrate what it is we're talking about, the complexity of this, and perhaps also how the nature of hate crime maybe has or has not changed, that in fact, yes, now we are talking about this disturbing trend, attacks on the homeless, and the argument that in fact that qualifies and that the criminal statutes ought to include that as a category of person who could qualify as a potential victim, and the charges against the assailant should say that.
One of the things that we found was that the crimes, when they're committed because of this kind of context, did not get punished adequately to reflect the harm to the community and the real terror that victims go through. You know, if I put a statement on your door about the Illinois basketball team, which I would never do, that would be taken one way. But if I put a statement about your race or religion, that's a bit more terroristic, don't you think? So one of the things that the law really grew to recognize was just how inadequate prior law was, particularly with regard to vandalisms and simple assaults.
We have another caller here to bring into the conversation. We could do that. Let's talk with caller here, line number one, and this would be in Urbana. Hello.
Good morning, Mr. Levin.
Hi.
A question from a wide scope and a narrow scope. The wide scope question is, from your perspective, do you see anything evolving in the United States on the level of the Know-Nothing movement of the 1850s? And on a narrow perspective, what are your comments regarding the series of burnings of churches by some college students who were recently apprehended sometime last year, I believe.
Right.
The Know-Nothings, they were against...
No, I'm familiar with the Know-Nothings, but please, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Yeah. But I was astounded to learn that from 1855 to 1857, the Speaker of the House of Representatives was a Know-Nothing.
Yes, and, you know, historically we've gone through periods where we've had a political movement that was much more isolationist against foreigners. And the Know-Nothing Party had a variety of planks to their platform. I don't think that you're going to find a new political party like the Know-Nothings that would have any degree of success. But I do think that these issues certainly are affecting the Republican Party as well as the Democratic Party, but in different ways. So, for instance, in the Democratic Party, I think there's a predisposition to look more at our history of taking in immigrants and a bit less on some of the national security concerns. However, on the Republican side, I think that you have more attention being paid to national security concerns, and unfortunately, I think that there have been some who have used that issues for not the most beneficial motives.
Okay, and for the narrow perspective of this recent series of, you know, really nasty church burnings, Did you keep track of that?
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that is really unfortunate. I was involved in looking at some of the church arsons that took place during the 1990s, and again, what it comes down to is that many of the church arsons that took place during the 90s, for instance, did not involve a racial motive. You had people who were just committing basic burglaries. You had other people who were doing it for excitement. And you had other people who were part of satanic groups. So you really had a cross-section of people that were involved, and also drug addicts as well, in addition to some insurance fraud and some people who did it for hateful reasons, like there were some Klansmen in North and South Carolina that were involved in arsons there. So you really had a cross-section of reasons on why people went after churches, and one of the reasons I think that we should look generally is that, you know, churches are symbols,
yeah.
And particularly for a variety of antisocial people, there'll be a variety of different motives as to why they'd want to attack one.
Yes. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just for a second to talk about the first point, the larger point the caller made, the Know-Nothing Party was their big thing was an anti-immigrant plank.
Absolutely.
And at that point it was Irish immigrants, Irish Catholics that they were particularly consumed by.
And also German.
Indeed. And so this is, and it's certainly not the only case of nativism in American politics. I'm sure there have been many points where concerns about immigration were the sort of burning issue in people's minds. Do you think that at this point that nativism in American politics is any stronger than perhaps it's ever been before?
Oh no, I don't think it's as bad as it was, for instance, during the 1920s, where the Klan had a tremendous resurgence on anti-Catholic bigotry and immigration, and even during the Know-Nothing period. But again, you know, the Know-Nothing Party, while it certainly was anti-immigration, they also had an isolationist view generally. But, you know, one interesting point about, you know, how we respond to immigrants. I was reading a book about the NYPD. I'm a former New York City police officer. And what I thought was so incredible is that there was such a degree of prejudice against Irish and German immigrants in New York that if you just crossed out the ethnic group and substituted groups that are more prominent today as far as immigration patterns,
mm-hmm.
very similar in the kind of fears and insecurities. And now, 100 years later, it's almost laughable that we even thought these things.
Well, it is stunning to the extent to which people still attribute the kind of negative characteristics that people attribute to immigrants, that they commit crimes, they carry disease, they're lazy, they really don't want to work, they don't want to learn English, they're just, you know, all of those kinds of things, that there's a very dramatic and very noticeable consistency in the complaints or the concerns that people have brought up about immigrants forever. They're always like that. They're saying those things now, and they were saying those things in the 19th century, and maybe even before that they were saying those things.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the term paddy wagon was a derogatory term directed towards the Irish, and then not so soon afterwards, they became the bulwark of the New York City Police Department. In fact, the first shooting in New York, the first officer-involved shooting, shootings involved an Irish immigrant and a German immigrant.
Hmm. Let's take another caller here. We have someone again in Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question for Dr. Levin.
Mm-hmm.
The host mentioned that you were also studying terrorism as well. And my particular interest is basically how you draw a distinction between terrorism and hate crime, especially since many acts of terrorism are designed to, or are motivated by hate, and many hate crimes are designed to instill terror. So how does one distinguish between the two? I'll hang up and listen for your
All right.
Great question. Great question. With regard to terrorism, we usually look at that as a more broad type of event. And if you look at the FBI's definition of terrorism, which talks about using force or intimidation to intimidate a population or subgroup, one of the things that I wrote in a law review article about 15 years ago was that technically, as the caller stated, hate crimes could very well be called terroristic. However, I think a key difference is that with crimes of terrorism, with terrorism, there is a more broad goal, and it is part of an overall mission that is beyond the individual offender who might do something on the spur of the moment. So while there is some overlap, I would say the thing that separates the two is hate crimes are something that we more reasonably want to classify as a generic type of crime, whereas terrorism is something that transcends a single event. It's part of a more broad movement and is directed as such. Now, if you were to say, wait a minute, if someone acts in a negative stereotype and commits a hate crime that has a terroristic effect, they're adhering to bigotry and hatred, which terrorists do, I'd agree. But I think you have a greater level of sophistication and organization with regard to terrorism than you do with hate crime. But I think there are instances where you might have a what we would call a mission offender, you know, who's like a hardcore white supremacist, like a Benjamin Smith who committed crimes in Illinois, for instance, and Indiana. He could probably be classified as both.
You know, we were talking earlier, right at the very beginning, where I raised this question about some recent reporting about Klan activity. And you said that that indeed, during a period roughly from between, say, 2001-2006, there was significant growth in the Klan, although at the same time, you have to say that nationwide, it's estimated that there are something between 5,000 and 7,500 active members of the Klan. And so when you consider how many people there are in the United States, that's even if it's at the high end, that's really not an enormous amount, a number of people. And that you said that one thing that perhaps, while it is important to monitor the activities of these kinds of groups, one of the things that you can say that's positive is that there does not seem to be much in the way of violence committed by Klan members or people like that. At the same time, you have to acknowledge the fact that before 9/11, the deadliest act of terrorism in American history was the bombing of the Oklahoma City, the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City in 1995 by Timothy McVeigh, who was a white supremacist. And you could see here that a small number of people could do something that would be extremely damaging and kill a lot of people. It wouldn't take more than a handful of people to do that. You know, having given the fact that that indeed happened, what kind of concern is there that some small number of people might be thinking about or might be prepared to carry out a violent act on that level again here in the United States?
Great question. Short answer, then I'll elaborate. Short answer, we don't know.
Yeah.
But I was speaking specifically with regard to the Klan itself. In other words, what kind of crimes could we trace back to Klansmen who were doing it in the carrying out of the mission of their group? And we haven't seen a lot of that over the last few years. We've seen rallies, to be sure. We've seen leafleting. We've seen a lot of nasty rhetoric. But we haven't seen the kind of crimes committed by Klansmen that we saw during the 50s and 60s, for instance, or even during the 1920s. So that's why I parsed the answer to specifically talk about the Klan. But I was at the McVeigh trial, and I think your point is extremely well taken. And that is, today, because of the quick exchange of information across vast geographic expanses, you don't even have to join a hate group to be inspired, directed, and then even trained to commit an act of mass terrorism. And I think that goes across the board to a variety of different extremist movements, going from the far left to the eco-terror movement, all the way over to the right-wing extremists, as well as the jihadis, so as well as other extremists as well. So short answer, the Klan, we haven't seen it. Does that preclude the possibility of a Klansman doing something? Absolutely not. But I think that there are other groups who are more violent today in their orientation who are on that side of the political spectrum.
Mm-hmm. We have another caller here. Let's talk with this person, and this is someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
What would be the profiles of the kinds of people that would commit crimes against the homeless? It's hard. This is hard for me to get my, you know, to fully understand.
Yeah. Why would anybody do that?
Yeah. What would be the profiles of these people that have committed these crimes?
Great question again. And what's really interesting is that the profiles, and again, you know, profiles are exactly that. They don't fit everyone. But for the kind that we're talking about, they actually fit with the most common type of hate crime offender overall. That is a younger person, oftentimes male, usually committing it in a small group for excitement based on a more aversive prejudice as opposed to a hardened prejudice. By the way, we still have cases, for instance, of neo-Nazis going out and beating up skinheads and committing various crimes against them because they're not pure, or in somehow they're not part of the pure, successful Aryan order. We certainly see that. But most of these crimes are committed by young people, oftentimes middle-class people, who are inspired by a desire for excitement that they couple with a negative stereotype.
Wow.
It's shocking. And one of the things, if you go to National Coalition for the Homeless, nationalhomeless.org, what you'll see is the majority of these offenders are young people in their early 20s or younger, and many of those attacked are middle-aged or older. One other quick thing, too. Don't forget intersecting identities. That is, about 40 to 45% of homeless. There's a HUD report just released this week. About 40, 45% are African-American, for instance. So these stereotypes oftentimes bleed across multiple identities.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Something that I want to make sure that we at least touch on when we talk about this kind of issue, you know, with the title we put on the program, Hate Crimes and Extremism in the United States, what people are going to think about are what we have talked about, that is organized groups, generally of white members that have this kind of white supremacist identification, neo-Nazis, skinheads, Ku Klux Klan, and so forth. And I think that it's important to acknowledge that, even though we're now about 5 minutes before having to finish up, important to acknowledge, as you said very early on, that most hate crimes are not committed by people who belong to organized groups. And I think that we also ought to acknowledge the fact that is that depending upon where you are, hate crimes are not, they're not all crimes that are committed by a white person against a minority, for example. You know, there are places where there are hate crimes that involve African-Americans and Asians, or African-Americans and Latinos, you know, one way or another. So this is not, I want to make sure that we say this is a complex thing. It's not just all one thing. Again, you know, depending on where you are, you could be talking about a different, the perpetrator and the victim could be any number of members of any number of groups.
You're absolutely right. For instance, look, here in Southern California, we had a high-profile trial recently in Long Beach where the assailants were African-American youth and the victims were white.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually not representative of this area. In Los Angeles County, the overwhelming majority of racial hate crimes are by and between African Americans and Latinos. Nationally, whites are the largest number of offenders. So it really depends on location. But I also will tell you the sad thing is we're really seeing a democratization of hate. And I think with regard to hate crimes, when we look at a couple of things that are causes, one are thrill and excitement, peer validation, but also turf protection. And as areas become more heterogeneous, particularly as minorities bump into other minorities, we're seeing that kind of hate crime occur in areas that are going undergoing demographic change. So that's something that we're starting to see in pockets nationally. African Americans are the most common victims nationally. They get attacked three times more than their proportion of their population. For religious groups, it's Jewish people. And for ethnic groups, it's Latinos.
So have we seen if you look at trends and this kind of crime that we're talking about, again, we're talking about crimes that are not committed. It's not the Klan. It's not people who are involved in some kind of organized group. It might be a gang. And so maybe that qualifies, or it just might be a loose affiliation of individuals. Have we started to see more, or have we been seeing more of these kinds of crimes? I mean, is the incidence of, if we just say, you know, what's the trend in incidence of hate crimes? What do you see?
The trend for some years was down to stable. It appears in the last year. And the thing is, we don't have data nationally for 06. We have some limited data for 05. You can check out the FBI's report on FBI.gov, but some jurisdictions did not participate. I think we bottomed out, and I think, again, we're starting to come up just in the last couple of years. What we've noticed in major cities like Los Angeles and New York is that we've seen some increases, but not necessarily in the same year. The other thing, too, is some of these are really hard to count statistically because they're big mob attacks that take place at schools, for instance. That's what we're seeing, for instance, in some parts of Southern California. But I think that things are getting a bit worse after many years where they appeared to be relatively stable.
We have one more caller. I want to make sure we try to get in before we run out of time. In Farina, this is line 4, the toll-free line.
Yep.
Hello. Yes.
Hi. Great topic. Thanks for mentioning the violence against the homeless. I think there's a feeling of elitism by many in society that against the lower classes. And one other point, that police brutality itself against demonstrators, against the poor, against the homeless, police brutality could almost be categorized as a hate crime. It fits your definition. Thank you.
Okay. Well, as you mentioned a little bit earlier, you're a former police officer. I don't know how you feel about something like that.
Well, you know, it's not so much how I feel about it. I don't know any professional police officer personally who's for it. However, from the Civil War era on, there was a division between how the law looked at these things. So in the Ku Klux Klan Acts after the Civil War, there was a specific statute, which is still in the books today and was used in the Rodney King case, 18 United States Code 242, which specifically targets law enforcement who violate civil rights. And because of their position in society and their authority, I think it's probably best to have separate statutes and separate accounting for those types of events.
Is there, I ask this question knowing that we maybe have about a minute or two left, is there any concern that extremist groups outside of the United States would form alliances with or act along with or through extremist groups inside the United States? And I realize because of their agendas that in fact might not happen. You know, I can't imagine neo-Nazis lining up with Al-Qaeda, but, you know, maybe something like that could happen. Is that too wild a kind of an idea to imagine?
You know, years ago, people would have said absolutely. Now we're just seeing the beginning threads of this kind of stuff. There was a prominent anti-Semite in Germany who became a Muslim convert, so he's trying to cross that bridge. David Duke spoke throughout the Persian Gulf. A Holocaust denial conference was held not too long ago in the Middle East. And I'm not talking about Iran. I'm talking about a private one by Western extremists. So, yeah, but we haven't seen that connection quite take place yet. Also, there's a split within the white supremacist community here in the United States where some lump Middle Easterners along with Jews as horrible, horrible people. Others take the tact, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. But right now, we're really just seeing minimal threads of potential relationships rather than anything that's at all operational. Mm. I mean, that's really on the horizon. but it's not anything that really exists in any meaningful way today.
Well, just very quickly, and as the sense that we're kind of bouncing around here, but because we did talk a little earlier about Oklahoma City and Tim McVeigh, there was a period, and it seemed to me this was maybe back in the 80s, when there was a lot of concern about militias, about extreme right-wing paramilitary groups that were, in some cases, significantly armed, were training in that manner, were seen to be have that kind of interest. Is there still a significant militia movement in the United States?
Not in the way that it was during the 90s. There certainly are survivalists. The problem is when you get into definitions. And what I'm saying is, as far as the extremist threat from militias, extraordinarily contained compared to what it was during the 90s. Are there those that still exist who are in it? Yes. But the militia movement, one of the things that made it most dangerous was that it got hijacked by white supremacists. So now white supremacists are looking to go and exploit immigration, and maybe they'll come back again. But the survivalist movement as a whole is much more contained and certainly not as active as it was, and the membership is much less than what it was during the mid-90s.
All right. Well, there we must leave it with our thanks to our guest, Brian Levin. He is Associate Professor of Criminal Justice and also Director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University at San Bernardino, where he studies hate crime, terrorism, legal issues. Professor Levin, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.